All right, well, we're not going to have a lot of time here, but let's go ahead and turn to the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel. We're just about to complete this. As you're turning there, let me share with you one more time. We have said several times as we've gone through the study that the book of Daniel is one of those that comes under constant criticism. And we've said that the reason that that's the case is because it is so historically accurate, it's frightening. And so the critic of the Bible says, look, this stuff is simply too accurate. It could not have been written by somebody who lived, 600 B.C. It had to have been written by somebody after. But we've settled that issue because Jesus himself attributes this work to Daniel himself. And so we know that regardless of what the critics say, and what even if there's evidence that would suggest that it's not really written by Daniel but someone at a later date, nevertheless, we're going to stick with what Jesus said and believe that Daniel was exactly who he said he was and that God revealed the things that he did. Now, when we really identified that when we came into chapter 8, but we started talking about the ram and the goat. You remember the representatives of Greece and of Persia and the conflict that was going on between those two countries in respect to the nation of Israel, because ultimately that's what this is all about. How God is working and his plans for his people, Israel, in the midst of the history of the world. Now, as we've gone from through the book of Daniel, we have seen the big picture with the Nebuchadnezzar's vision. Remember, which showed us all of the world empires that would rule and their relationship to Israel from man's perspective, being the solid metals. Remember, we saw the gold head and the silver and all of that kind of stuff. And then in chapter 7, we saw God's version of the same empires, but from his view, these kingdoms of men are nothing more than beasts, and we saw that in the vision that Daniel had of the beasts. So we started sort of on this big format. Then we moved into chapter 8, and when we looked at chapter 8, we kind of whittled it down, and we went now to the next two kingdoms, and that was the ram and the goat, again, being Persia and Greece. And then when we come to chapter 9, we saw the breakdown of the 70 weeks. Now, we're going to talk about that just briefly here in a few minutes, but let me conclude this thought. And as we begin to move down and we go into chapter 10, we move from the physical realm and all the things that are happening, and this is what Mike shared last week, and we moved into the spiritual realm, and we get an understanding from the book of Daniel that what is taking place within the physical is ultimately a sort of a representation, I guess, of what is taking place in the spiritual. Now, we often forget about the spiritual because we get caught up in the physical. We look at things that are around us, and though we know and we've read in the scripture that Paul talks about our wrestling match is not against flesh and blood, it's not against man, in other words, but it's against these principalities and so on and so forth in the spiritual realms. And we tend to forget that that's where the real conflict is, and that's why prayer is so significant, because it's prayer that goes beyond the realm of the physical and pierces even the realm of the spiritual to get to the very throne of God. And when you looked at chapter 10 last week, you saw that, because as Daniel begins to pray and he's waiting for an answer, you saw there that Gabriel reports to Daniel that said, hey man, when you started praying 3 weeks ago, I was dispatched to come, but I was withstood by the prince of Persia. And we know that, I'm assuming that Mike covered all of this, that the prince of Persia is the spiritual power, the demon, if you will, that controls the country of Persia. And it's interesting when you begin to think about the use of the word the prince of Persia in relation to a demonic activity, because Paul said, remember, we wrestle not against but against principalities. You see, the prince is or principalities is the root of that word that goes on to say that. And so you've got this whole thing where these guys, these powers, these authorities are ruling, and of course they're related to as princes there. But what's interesting about that is that Gabriel says that we did all of this and I was actually held in check until Michael, the great archangel, came and set and freed me up to be able to deliver the message that God had sent. And he said, but soon I'm going to have to face the prince now of Greece, because now you see another kingdom is entering the picture in the sequence of those visions that we talked about, and that of course is going to be Greece, and primarily they're going to establish the foothold under Alexander the Great. Okay, But all of this is taking place, and you can see it sort of whittling down, and we're getting closer and closer to and sort of more focused in what's going on. When we come to chapter 11, what we're going to discover in chapter 11 is we're going to be, as we read through this and get as much as we can of it at least, we're going to see that what is identified for us in chapter 11 is the 69 weeks. Now, that's referring back to chapter 9 and the 70-week prophecy. You remember, there are three distinct categories in that prophecy. Gabriel tells Daniel that 77s have been decreed. There is first, the first group is the seven sevens, which we know were 49 years. And within that 49-year period, that was when the decree would go out, or 49 years from the time the decree went out, that the city would be rebuilt. And that did take place, the issuing of March 6th, 445 BC, by Xerxes, and allowing this to take place. And we see that actually happening, the rebuilding of the city and its walls, as we read the book of Nehemiah. So that's the first group, the seven sevens, the 49 years. And then Gabriel said there's seven sevens decreed and 62 sevens. Now the 62 sevens, that's chapter 11. Okay, there's 434 years of history in chapter 11, and they are the 62 the 62 sevens. Did I say 69 or did I say 62? I meant 62. There were seven. There's 62 now, which brings it to 69, because the 70th is yet in the future. Okay, so we're going to be looking at the 62 sevens. In other words, 62 periods of 7 years, 434 years. That's what chapter 11 is. Okay, so it's whittling this all down, and it's dealing with this now specifically with the nation of Israel and how all of this is going to affect it. And we're going to be introduced in chapter 11 to somebody that we've already met. Remember the great boastful horn and so on and so forth, the guy with the big mouth. We're going to see him show up. We're probably not going to get to that tonight. We'll touch on that next week. But that is what is taking place here. Now, in the first four verses of our chapter is a general picture of what's going on, and it's the conflict that took place between Persia and Greece. And it's interesting because I was just talking to Bob earlier. Some of you may know this, and I know it's not the kind of movie that some would want to see, but there's this new movie out that's called The 300. And what that portrays is these 300 Spartans. It's a true historical fact that this actually happened around, I believe it was around 400 BC, if I'm not mistaken, 430 BC, somewhere in there. But that these actual 300 soldiers from Sparta held off, like upwards of, the estimates go from hundreds of thousands into actually a million Persian soldiers that Xerxes sent. And these 300 guys were able to hold off and slaughter literally thousands of these Persians. But ultimately, of course, they met their fate, and we know what ends up happening. He gets in there, and this ticks the guys off in Greece, and so then they rebel and they go after him, and that's when Persia is overcome by the Greeks, Alexander being the one that ultimately drives the nail into the coffin. So that's the period of history that we're talking about, identified for us by Daniel's the second group of sevens. That we see, remember the seven sevens, 62 sevens, that's seven, that's what's happening here, okay? Does that make sense? Did I got to go a little fast in there? But so there's 434 years. Now, what's interesting also about this is this 430 years will conclude with who? With Jesus. Jesus, we're going to see we're going to identify, and at least his appearing on the scene, because he is what concludes that second group of sevens. And remember then, in that the rest of that prophecy, there's a gap between the seven sevens, the 62 sevens, in other words, 69 sevens, and that 70th. There's a gap that exists. That 70th seven has not happened yet. There's still a seven-year period. That gap is where we are living right now. So we're waiting for that 70th seventh to come on the scene at some point in the future, when we're going to be introduced to this guy here once again, and we're going to see that it applies to somebody historically, but also looks way, way beyond this person as a historical figure. So the 70th week is yet to be fulfilled, and we'll get to that. Actually, we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the chapter 12. But this is a period that begins with the conflict between Persia and Greece, and will end, conclude, I should say, when Jesus comes and is cut off for his people, which of course then begins at the day of Pentecost, the church age, which is that gap between the 69 sevens and 70th. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay? All right, so let's go ahead and begin to read in verse 1. There's a ton of ground to cover here. I'll be honest with you, usually I read and I study and I look through commentaries and I do all the research and all of this stuff to identify what's going on here, and then I sort of bring all of that together and I put my notes, and that's what I share with you guys. This chapter is so full and so accurate historically with dates and changes between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, back and forth and back and forth, and that's why it's so historically accurate, it scares the critic. But there's so much there that I just ended up actually, from bringing over the commentary that I had on the computer, actually bringing their notes over instead of trying to create mine, because there's no point in trying to redo all of this. So I'm going to just touch on some of that. It's very interesting reading if you're interested in this, and this is one of those chapters that a lot of people read, and even believers, they'll read this and they'll say, this is the reason I don't really like to study the Old Testament. Because this is one of those chapters that's like, oh, this king of the, who the heck is the king of the south? Who's the king of the north? What does this daughter and this marriage have to do with anything? And how come the south and southern guys are ruling and then the northern guys overcome them and then they fight again and blah, blah, blah. And so people tend, this is the kind of stuff that people tend to blow off. But folks, it is so significant because it identifies for us who we are and why we are where we are as Americans. It's an amazing thing, and we must understand that. So that's my purpose in trying to help, you know, to teach this stuff, is to get us to the point where we recognize that. It's not important that you remember all these dates, though there will be a quiz at the end of the service. No, just kidding. Verse 1. Okay, also in the first year of Darius the Mede. Now remember, Daniel is having all of these visions that God has given him at the beginning of the rule of the Persians. Remember that, okay? That's significant. So what Gabriel is revealing to him is what's going to happen from that point on. Because for Daniel now, up to Darius, it's all history. But now it's future, it's prophecy, okay? So he says, also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I'm taking that back. This is Gabriel still speaking, and this is another thing that really, one of those things that just aggravates me about the translators. Verse 1 of chapter 11 is actually, should be the last verse of chapter 10. I don't know why they did that, because there's some identification here, and if you go back to chapter 10, and I don't have my notes to go back to 10, if I did, I would, but... Yeah, this is Gabriel still speaking to Daniel. So also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I, that is Gabriel speaking, stood up to confirm and strengthen him. Now there's a lot of debate over who the him is here. Is he saying, because Gabriel has just said that Michael came and rescued me, so is Gabriel saying that Michael was able to rescue me, and so I sort of returned the favor and I stood with him? In other words, is Michael the him here, Michael the archangel, or is it Darius the Mede? I tend to believe it's Darius, because we know that Darius was really, you know, really moved by the things of God, having understood the prophecy in Jeremiah, which named him, right? Some, you know, 100 years before, whatever it was, 200 years. And so that's just a Rickism, take it or leave it, but whatever. So we're not really sure who that is. And verse 2, and now I will tell you the truth. Remember, Gabriel is still speaking here. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. That is none other than Xerxes. If you've read the book of Ruth, if you saw the movie A Night with the King, then you would recognize that king, Xerxes, as Ahasuerus. That was his name. And he was a great king, a great Persian king, and he was the one that stopped Haman from destroying the Jews, right? But he was a great king based on what this happened, and he ruled up until about 530 BC. And then I would give you the names of these other guys, but I don't think it's really important. He's actually the last king. He ruled from, as I said, from 485 to 465, and he was constantly fighting with Greece. And if you remember in the movie, and if you read the story of Esther, it's not clearly identified there, but if you know the history, you understand that that's the significance of what's taken place there, was the conflict that he was already facing, and it was getting deeper and hotter all the time as he was dealing with Greece, in particular, some of these other individuals. Now, he was not dealing with Alexander the Great, because Alexander the Great didn't come until about 330. So he lived about 100 years before Alexander, so there's a bunch of stuff. Anyways, then a mighty king shall rise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Now that's identifying for us Alexander the Great. Now Alexander, if you know history, he ruled from 334 to 330. He is the one that established the rule of the Greeks and Hellenized the world. In other words, he made the world that he had conquered speak Greek, okay? And this was already, this statement that Gabriel has now given to Daniel, remember, has been identified because Alexander was the belly and thighs of brass in the vision, in chapter 2 of the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw. He's identified as the leopard of the vision of chapter 7 that Daniel receives from God of the beasts. And then he's also identified as the goat in chapter 8, because the goat comes and wipes out the ram, remember, which represented Persia. So he's already been identified for us, okay? And then in verse 4, and when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided towards the four winds of heaven. Now, if you remember what we talked about before, you'll already know where this is going. But not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others beside these. Now, what's happening here is that, remember, Alexander never married, and he never had any offspring, and he never appointed anyone to rule after him, because he died at 30-whatever years old. Okay, a lot of speculation as to how and why, but he had already conquered the world, but he had nobody to give his kingdom to. So his kingdom was divided once he passed away. His four generals divided up that kingdom. Okay? Now remember, this has also been identified for us, because if we go back to chapter 8, we saw it in the goat with the prominent horn, and remember that prominent horn is uprooted by four small horns. That's these same four guys. Now chapter 11, from this point on, is going to key in on two of those. Their names were Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. We're not worried about Cassander and Lysimachus, because those guys ruled Rome and Greece and Macedonia and so on and so forth. So the scripture is not concerned with them, because they don't relate to the nation of Israel. But it is interested in Ptolemy and Seleucus, because they are going to have direct involvement with the nation of Israel. So it's going to turn to two of those horns that have already been identified for us, okay? And that's what's being talked about here in that particular verse. Then in verse 5, now we're going to see now it's going to go from sort of the conquering or the conquest of the world to conflict between the two areas that these two guys ruled that we know today as Syria and Egypt. And this is the easiest way to remember it. S for Syria, that's where Seleucus ruled. That's the only way I can ever remember it. Ptolemy ended up gaining control of Egypt, okay? And so Seleucus, he got the northern realms. He got Babylon, Macedonia, Syria, and so on and so forth, and made himself king. And so all of the people that followed him, his descendants, became known as, in this particular chapter, the kings of the north. Ptolemy got control of Egypt and was named king in 304 BC after Alexander's death. And then his descendants became kings of Egypt, even though they were Greek in descent. And they ended up being called the kings of the south. Now that's important, because as we move through the rest of the letter, and I'm just going to point out a couple of highlights, there's a ton here, believe me. Of stuff that's going on, but I'm just going to point out a couple of the things. But you'll see this conflict between the kings of the north and the kings of the south. And the interesting thing that we need to keep in mind is who's between the kings of the north and the kings of the south? The nation of Israel is right in the middle. And so the kings from the north would march down on the kings of the south, and they'd trample down the city of Jerusalem and the nation of Israel, and they'd go down and they'd war, and then they'd get whooped. At first they were getting whooped, and then they'd return, and then they'd go back, and so they'd go back through Israel and being upset because they lost the battle, and they'd bring a bunch of more, you know, problems to the city. And then Ptolemy would rise in the south, and he would go up to the north, marching once again through Israel, and he would go up and fight, and for a while he was victorious, and then he gets turned around by the Seleucids, and he's sent back down, so he recrosses Israel, and then the kings from the north come back through Israel again. I mean, it's this constant thing with Israel in the middle, just keep going over this. Now this answers a lot if you've ever looked at some of the descendants and stuff and wondered why some of the people groups like in Syria and so on and so forth, when they do DNA testing, their roots are, they find that they relate back to Greece and they relate back to Macedonia. Well, how did all that happen? Chapter 11 of Daniel. See? So anyway, so you understand the nature of what's taking place here and why it's significant that Gabriel is telling this to Daniel. Now remember, this is 500 years in the future, well, a couple hundred years in the future, for Daniel, that he's telling him this stuff. Okay? So Daniel, I'm sure, doesn't understand it any more than most people that never really studied it. He just recorded it, and we're going to see that in chapter 12. So here we go in verse 5. Now, also the king of the south shall become strong. Now, remember, that's the Ptolemies, as well as one of his princes. And he shall gain power over him and have dominion, and his kingdom, or his dominion shall be great. So at first, when the first started to rule the south, Egypt, with the combined might of the Ptolemies with the Egyptians and the Cushites and Ethiopians and everybody else that was down in that southern area, they were much stronger than the Seleucids up in the north. And so for the first part of the history, as you look at this thing, they really were in control. Now verse 6, and at the end of some years they shall join forces. Now what he's talking about, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom are going to join forces. I won't bore you with all the details, but basically what happened was, you know, this guy killed off this guy, and in the north and in the south they killed off this guy, and suddenly you had two guys ruling that absolutely hated each other beyond anything that their predecessors had done. And so they ended up really despising one another, and they recognized the fact that should they continue this path, that they would destroy themselves. So they made a deal. And the deal that they made was for one of the kings, the king of the south, to give his daughter, whose name was Bernice, to give her in marriage to the king of the north, to Antiochus, okay? That's one of the first Antiochuses that you see that's going on here. And the guy in the south, the king, was Ptolemy the second. So Ptolemy the second gives his daughter, Bernice, and she's got a brother that's going to show up on the scene here in a minute, which really changes things, but he gives his daughter to Antiochus the second up there in the north to try to settle this agreement. Okay, so now let me read on so you can see what's going on. At the end of some years they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. Okay, so because of this alliance that's made over poor Bernice, Antiochus, to receive this, he divorces his wife, whose name is Laodicea. Sound familiar? Laodicea, right? The church of Laodicea. But that was her name. And so Antiochus divorces her so that he can marry Bernice. Well, Laodicea, she gets upset about this. So ultimately, she poisons Bernice. Okay? And because her husband divorced her, she kills him off too. And then she kills off Ptolemy, and she does all of this other stuff and everything. And of course now, because the Ptolemy is killed in the south, and Bernice is now dead in the south, Bernice's brother gets wind of this, and he comes, and he goes back, and he kills her, and slaughters everybody. So this is the history of the world, right? What a great picture it paints. But it's interesting to me that this stuff was written like 500 years before with such intricate detail that even this daughter exchange and this marriage to try to settle these issues was absolutely amazing to me. And this, of course, just builds the hatred between these guys. All right? So now if we move down to verse 7, but a branch from her roots, that's one shall rise in his place, who shall come with an army, even the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. So now you got the north guys overtaking them again, right? Now here we go. And he shall carry their goods captive to Egypt. He goes up north, wipes them out of north, and then he brings stuff back into Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. And he does. He outlives her brother, the guy in the north, and one of the Seleucid kings. Verse 9, now also the king of the north shall come to the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. So the guy in the north now, he marches on Egypt, thinking he's going to get back. Egypt wipes him out, kicks his butt. Oop, oop, you know what I'm saying. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. Oh, that snuck out before I could stop it. Oh. Whoops up on him. Oh, man, he turns tail, and he returns to the north. Dang it, I hate when I do that. I could feel it, and I was just like, stop, stop, and it just kept coming. Anyway, I know, man. So anyway, he goes down there and tries to overtake this, but he gets beaten back, and so he returns back to the north, okay, with his tail tucked between his legs. Let's see. Verse 10, however, his son shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of even greater force, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. So now you see this is just like this big pot, this boiling pot of stuff that's just going on of all of these nations. And Israel is right in the middle of all of this, completely unable to do anything about it. And then in verse 11, and the king of the south shall be moved with rage because this guy marched him. How dare he, right? And he'll go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. And when he has taken away, so the king of the south, the guy in the north musters an army, but he's defeated, his heart lifted up, and he was cast down with tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. And that's what ended up happening. After the guys went north and they fought up there, then that took those guys off. So now they came down and brought even more soldiers and really did some serious damage. Now, verse 14. Now, in those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south, also violent men. Now notice this, of your people. Who's he talking to? Daniel. Who's Daniel's people? Israel. And that's exactly what happened historically. The people of Israel, of the nation, even though they were trampled underfoot by the kings of the north and the kings of the south, they didn't like the guys in the south. They were more threatened by them. So the guys in the north, they bring in some Mesopotamians, they bring in what we would recognize today as Iraqis and Persians and so on and so forth, and add all of this stuff together, and as they're marching through, the people of Israel join with them to march against the south. Now, it's a foolish thing for them to do, because ultimately there's going to come a guy out of this line who's going to be named Antiochus Epiphanes, and he is going to be a rotten individual, and we're going to be talking about him more next week. Actually, we may get another new I'm trying to get through this as fast as I can. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mount. So he's going down to the south, and he'll take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Now you see the pendulum has swung to the north. Now they're going to overcome, for the last time, ultimately, the kings of the south. Even his choice troops shall have no strength, his special forces, the guy in the south. Even his special forces are not going to be able to stand. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. The king of the north is then going to stand in the glorious land, and he's going to expel his power. Now, this is still not Antiochus Epiphanes, but it's getting close. And the reason he's doing that is because Israel has allied with him, which was a terrible, terrible thing for them to do, and they will pay dearly for that decision. Verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him, thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or before him. You got another wife thing coming into this thing, and I won't bore you with the details, but there's another thing that's going on in a truce, but obviously that's not going to be the case. Then in verse 18, and after this he shall turn his face to the coastlands. He's going to go in now into Philistia and Tyre and Sidon and so on and so forth, these places. But a ruler shall bring the reproach against him to an end. And with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face, or turn toward the fortress of his own land. But he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So after all of this stuff, the guy dies. And interestingly enough, this individual dies not by being in combat. All this time he had fought in that, he falls off his horse and is killed. Imagine that. That's why he says, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. The dude's toast. Verse 20, and this is where we'll be able to close here tonight. Now, verse 20, and when we get to 21, we're really going to identify this, but this is where everything turns, because now we're going to enter this rotten individual. There shall rise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. That's still not Antiochus Epiphanes, but this guy was his predecessor. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. This guy was like his predecessor that fell off the horse and died. This guy didn't die in battle either. By the way, his name was Seleucus Philopator, whatever, 187 to 176 B.C., he was poisoned because he put such a heavy burden and taxes on his people that they poisoned him. This now has opened the door for probably the greatest, other than Hitler, one of the greatest tyrants ever to live on the earth. This fellow by the name, who was one of the Seleucid kings, or rulers, I should say, wasn't literally a king, but, and his name is Antiochus Epiphanes. And he's the one that is going to turn the tide. He is a pre-runner, if you will, to the Antichrist. Everything this guy did was what the Antichrist will do, but the Antichrist will do more than he could possibly do, because Antichrist will fight against Christ himself, whereas of course Antiochus Epiphanes could not. Okay, so that's where we are. Now the stage is set for this guy to enter into the picture. and he is going to get control of the whole shebang. And he is going to, as Paul said of the coming Antichrist, he is going to set himself up as God. He is going to stop the worship of the true God. It's interesting that we're on that point when we were talking about worship just earlier. But the true worship of God, he can't stand this, as you can possibly imagine. He is going to put a stop to that. He's going to put a stop to the sacrifices. He's going to desecrate the temple. He's going to do all of the stuff. But he is as bad as he was, and he's going to slaughter thousands and thousands. But he is still nothing in comparison to the person yet to come. Because that guy will wreak havoc, that which the world has never seen. And that's where we'll go now when we finish the chapter 11 and we move into chapter 12, because we're going to start now identifying this conqueror, Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay? Now, I know that's just sort of blazing a trail right through that. I'm 5 minutes behind where I wanted to be to finish this thing. But I would highly recommend that you get, if you don't have, get some commentaries or go with under Blue Letter Bible on stuff and read this. I know it's kind of boring with all of this history and all of these dates, but it is unbelievable. And the world recognizes these guys and everything that they did precisely as Daniel recorded it, you know, verbatim, as the angel Gabriel gave this prophecy to him, which is why people say it could not have been Daniel that wrote these things. I mean, everything from Bernice and the wife later on down the road, the whole thing switching back and forth was so historically accurate that the Bible critic says it couldn't possibly be. And yet, of course it is. And it shouldn't surprise us, because we've seen throughout the book of Daniel that God is sovereign and he rules the nations and he does as he pleases. And this was in his plan, that Jerusalem would be run over back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and that they would embrace this person called Antichrist. They thought he was the greatest thing since popcorn when he first showed up, right? They thought he was. I mean, they joined forces with him and with his minions and stuff like that, only to have it turn back and come back upon them. Now, interestingly enough, that's precisely what's going to happen in the future, isn't it? When the one world ruler shows up, Israel's going to do the same thing, because he's going to bring them the peace that they have always searched for, always wanted. And they are going to hold him up, and they're going to put him on a pedestal, and they're going to try to recognize him as the Messiah, the awaited Messiah. You see, folks, nothing's changed. 600 BC to 2000, whenever, right? Nothing changes. The nation of Israel has been just wandering aimlessly from God's plans and purposes for them since time immemorial. Well, you're going to get the idea, right? I mean, they just don't get it. It's amazing. And the consequences of those foolish acts are obvious for all to see. And tragic. I mean, it's sad that they have had to go through the things. But God has taken every concern to show them what is taking place, that it's according to his plan. But like they did in Jeremiah's day, no, we're God's people. God would never give us up to the Babylonians. And Jeremiah wept. Right? God's plans and purposes for his people. We don't know them. We don't understand them. We do the best that we can. Someday we will. But he's also got a plan for us, his people. Because if you read 9, 10, and 11 of Romans, chapters 9, 10, 11, the church now, and that's that gap we talked about between the 69 weeks and the 70th, where we are today in the church age, God has a plan and a purpose for us. We need to pray that we don't miss it like they did. Because the deception is coming, a deception so great when this individual enters the picture, that Paul himself wrote that the deception is so great that even the elect will be deceived if it were possible. That's how great it will be. And we keep seeing these guys more and more, right? You guys seen this guy in the news now? There's another Messiah out there. Do you know that? I can't remember what his name is, but he's running around and telling everybody he's Jesus again. He's going to find out, just like the rest of them, that he isn't. And it's, you know, it's, I know you watch this guy and you see this guy and you go, oh, how can you do this? And that's bad enough. But then they interview his followers, this young woman, very pretty young lady, and she's so full of life, and she's, you know, in her 20s, and she's so energetic, and they're, who is this guy? Oh, he's Jesus Christ returned. And I'm just going, oh my gosh, it just breaks your heart.
But people can really get to see
absolutely.
The spirit in them.
That's exactly right. And that is
that's
why,
spooky.
That's very spooky. That's why we better be about a stinking business.
Yeah.
And not waste time. Because, you know, if this yo-yo shows up in Mesquite, how many? How many from here will follow him? Which means that we haven't done such a very good job. Yeah, yeah. Well, God's people will, surely will not. We'll recognize him for who he is. But the point is, there are a lot of people out there that don't. Why don't they? You know, this building, we talked about this, the worship, the teaching of the word. What is it for? Is it so we can get smarter and, you know, and ooh and ah at how accurate the Bible is? No, it's so that we can go out there and warn these people, man, that there is these kind of yo-yos out there. And that shouldn't surprise us, because that's exactly what Jesus said. Remember when they say, look, here is Messiah, or there is Messiah, don't believe it. Don't believe it. Well, people, you know how many people in the church have said, well, what if this somebody shows up in there? How are we going to recognize him? It's like,
because he's coming in the
temple. Well, that's just, I mean, that's the point. It's like, but Jesus said, look, you don't got to worry about it, because when I appear, every eye's going to see.
Exactly.
I mean, it's going to, there's not going to be any question. It's not going to be some guy walking around who's losing his hair and wearing glasses like everybody else. Jesus is coming back. There's going to be a uniqueness about that that is unprecedented. And so our job, our role, our responsibility is to learn these things, not to make our heads bigger, so that we might take these things and go outside these walls and tell people. And if you're in a restaurant or something and this yo-yo Christ shows up on the TV screen, you know, there's a great opportunity to say, folks, whatever you do, don't believe this guy. If you really want the truth, you need to come to Jesus Christ. Let me share that with you. You say, well, I could never do that. Well, you better do that. I mean, it's a frightening thing to think about. Sheep led to the slaughter. Man, oh man, oh man. The blind leading the blind both fall in the ditch.
It seems to me that the greater majority of people see that sort of thing, and they buttress their own position of not having faith, because you can never know who the true Messiah
right,
yeah.
is.
So
yeah.
There may be a few people that get deceived.
Right, that's a good point.
Talks about
yeah.
The great deception. The more I see this sort of thing, the skeptic on the outside, that's the greater tragedy. The skeptic says, who do you believe? I'm not going to believe. I'm going to chart my own.
That's right. You know what? And that's why I think these guys, and I'm not saying this one, and I'm telling you, he's out there. Just keep watching the news. You're going to see him. I'm telling you, he's out there. I've seen him twice on TV. I've happened to catch it. And but I think that's why, whether this guy is the one or not, but these other false guys that are coming in, you know what's going to follow them besides their teaching? And what's going to change those people? I think miracles.
Yeah.
This guy's going to raise the dead. He's going to heal the blind. He's going to do all of this stuff. People recognize that garbage going on what is it, TBN? You know, all that false healing and stuff. They recognize that for what it is. But when this guy shows up, when these guys show up.
You're talking about the Antichrist.
No, I'm talking about these false Christ and stuff. I think he's going to definitely do it. But I think that they're going to be able to do miracles as well. You know, that's one of the things I think that's going to lead to the deception. I mean, I have no way of knowing that, but it seems to me, for the exact reason that you just said, you know, how is he going to draw all of these people in? Well, he's going to do something. You know, well, I'm following this guy. You guys keep talking about your Jesus coming back and blah, blah, blah. Well, this guy's here. You know, he's living proof. Look at what he just did here. He's not like those yo-yos we watch on TV, which can't duplicate these miracles anywhere but in there when they're on screen, you know. Well, exactly.
The demon that is over Persia, the world does not belong
yeah.
to us. It belongs to the enemy. So he has charge over the world. Yes, our God allows him to do it and can shut him off any time, but he's not. He has a purpose for it. So if we don't know the word, then how are we going to stand against? And that's why deception is so great, because it is going to be in our face and it is going to be real. And people think if it's real, it's got to be true. No, it's not true.
Yeah.
It's the enemy.
Yeah.
They get to see it every day, and just every day,
oh, yeah.
That's how they'll follow.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and that's the sad part. You know, it's interesting. She brought that up again.
What if this
You know, we think about this, like we talked about, the prince of Persia, the prince of Greece, and we're like, ooh, wow, so there was a prince of Babylon, yeah, well, and there's a prince of this, oh, yeah, yeah. But how many times have we ever stopped to think, do you realize that there's a prince of the United States as well?
Yeah, prince of guitar man.
No, not that prince. But I mean, you see what I'm saying? It's easy to think about those guys and to think about this demonic control over them. But we never, how often do we really think of that demonic control of this, whoever the prince is, this guy over the United States of America?
And they work through people. That's why.
Sure, they're called the ACLU.
I'm just kidding. What was Mike telling us about that Charmin guy or whatever, you know, when they were traveling, and so they paid the guy, Mike would pay the people that he was with, paid the guy because he had powers over.
Oh, yeah. The demons.
Yeah, I know, but he had powers over the air where mm-hmm. he could control the weather. Well, it's because he's allowed the demon
sure.
to make deals, you know, and it actually happened. And so you're like, ooh, ooh. Well, it happens.
When did this happen?
It doesn't happen.
Just a couple.
My point is that it happened.
Yeah.
And that we're
ignorant to it.
And
yeah.
When it does happen, you're like, oh, well, that must be real. But it's of the enemy.
Yeah. And we need to recognize it.
And the people like who's claiming to be
What she's talking about is in Tibet when Michael was making one of the journeys out to the Dolpa. I think I shared this with you last year. I'm not sure if you guys remember or not, and I'll just try to tie this in briefly. But what he did is they came to this thing, and of course he's with Rob K, who is not a believer yet. I don't know why, but he's not. Anyway, they came to this thing, and they were with this group of people, and the weather was not going to permit them to go through. So they pulled one of these Tibetan guys out, these Tibetan monks who was like a shaman. And he was able to control the weather, and so they paid the guy. Michael didn't, but they paid the guy, and the guy said, "Well, then I will control and keep the storm off of you guys." And remember, when Michael goes, it's like over the top of a mountain, and it's through a valley, and then up another. And the guy told them, he said, "Look, but I can only control the spirit that controls from this peak to that peak. Once you're on that peak, I have no control." So they paid the guy, he did his incantations, and Michael said, it was like this black sitting right over the top of us, like it was going to downpour. And he said, "Rick," I said, "I'm telling you for sure," this is what he told me last year, and then he, of course, told Marie this year. He said, "The minute we got to the top of that other peak and started over the other side," he said, "it let loose like you would not believe." He said, "And I know people say I'm crazy," he said, "but I'm telling you, I'm not." He said, "I saw it. I was there." So then that's her point. So this is a reality. But again, see, the problem we have is what you're talking about is that we think, oh, well, but that's Tibet and that's the Himalayas, right? And there's Tibet Buddhism there and there's Hinduism. Well, of course, there's all this darkness and there's all this occultic practice going on. Well, you would expect that in a place like that. But we never stop to think of the control that the enemy has over this country. Yeah, absolutely we do. But it's disguised. You don't see it as darkness here. It's a false light. And but it's ever bit as dark as that stuff in Tibet. And we better pay heed. This is who we're fighting against, huh?
Higher criticism, intellectualism.
Yeah, amen, amen.
You reduce it to, basically to, you know, atheism.
Yeah.
Which says that supernatural isn't a real thing.
Yeah, amen. Amen. Well, Mr. Higher Criticism, you want to close us in prayer? That's a pretty big word. I can't even say it. I say words from the pulpit I'm not supposed to say.
Well, people tend to forget that these great deceivers aren't going to come looking like a bad guy.
Well, exactly. Well, there's and that's the point everybody misses. Deceiver. Hello. If he shows up with horns and a pitchfork, we're going to run from him. Ready? Yeah, go ahead and close.